It's Friday, July 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, what's next for the Greek economy as a crucial vote looms?
You know, the Egyptian policing model has always been viewed as heavy-handed, conducting searches and things like that, and in the process, alienate people who have been neutral in the past who might go over to support the opposition.
Egypt struggles with security measures against terrorism. Also ahead, a good U.S. jobs report may or may not be good news. And we hear about music's BET Awards. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. The International Monetary Fund says that debt-ridden Greece's financial plight is even worse than its first thought as the country heads to Sunday's vote on whether to accept lenders' demands for more austerity in exchange for new bailout loans. VOA's Jeffrey Young turned to Alex Nicol. He's a senior fellow at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London to figure out the Greek government's strategy.
It's very hard to know what exactly the motivations of the Greek government are at this time. It's a very confusing situation. Clearly, Mr. Tsipras is putting this package, which isn't really on the table anymore anyway, to voters in as a means to try to get additional leverage over other European governments, his creditors. And because if he's recommending that they reject, that voters reject the package, and he hopes that if they do say no, that he'll be able to go back to other governments and say, you see, I have democratic backing for easier terms for Greece.
Why would a referendum in Greece, whatever position that referendum may take, influence the finance ministers? They're the ones who have to decide, are we going to give more money to Greece or not?
It's true that right now we have a very antagonistic situation, that he has alienated the finance ministers and government leaders with whom he needs to do business if Greece is, you know, not to go belly up. There's a very poor atmosphere right now. And I don't think that a no vote is really going to sway them towards offering better terms in this atmosphere. Nevertheless, I think we have to look at what the ultimate aims of both sides are. And I do think that both sides do genuinely want to keep Greece within the euro, the common currency of 19 European countries.
If Greece were forced to issue so-called junk bonds, high-risk bonds, where do you think the pricing of that risk would be? What kind of interest rate would it take to buy into a precarious piece of paper?
Well, as you say, right now, Greece is in effect locked out of capital markets. Its only potential source of funding is other governments right now, and the governments that Greece is dealing with aren't prepared to lend unless there's some promises made by Greece that are credible. I think it's impossible to tell what a real market rate for Greece might be right now if they were borrowing, because in the absence of a credible package of reforms by Greece, nobody would really be prepared to lend to them. So even on the junk bond market, if such a market were even to exist as a possibility for Greece, and I don't think politically that's really feasible right now, and I don't actually think that we're there yet.
Well, the International Monetary Fund, as we mentioned, said that Greece's financial plight is even worse than first thought. First of all, we'd like to introduce G. Abby Lee to our International Edition team.
Hi, Jim. Thanks.
Hi, G. She's going to be following social media for us, and we're excited. G., what are some of the comments that you've been seeing?
Well, hashtag IMF has been mentioned in more than 23,000 tweets in the past 24 hours, and one of the users tweeting the hashtag was Project Syndicate, which is an online platform that publishes and syndicates commentary on a number of topics. It's at ProSyn on Twitter, and it wrote, "The IMF needs to heed its own advice and evidence on debt restructuring." Jim, I'd like to turn your attention to a prominent American politician who blasted the IMF. He's a 2016 Democratic presidential candidate and progressive lawmaker. Can you guess who it is?
Let's try Bernie Sanders.
Exactly. Sounds like something he would do, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Vermont senator wrote an exclusive statement to the Huffington Post and attacked the IMF and European authorities for imposing what he called excessive austerity measures on Greece. Sanders argued it's unacceptable that the IMF and European policymakers have refused to work with the Greek government on a sensible plan to improve its economy and pay back its debt. He went on to demand the U.S. and other world powers to grant Greece new debt repayment terms to allow its economy to recover from the financial crisis. Sanders is on Twitter at Bernie Sanders.
Oh, what are people saying about that piece on the internet?
So I went on to the Huffington Post website and read the top two comments by social ranking. The most popular comment was by a user named Carpenters for Bernie Sanders, and they wrote, "To read the comments here, you get the impression few Americans know what really caused the crisis in Greece. Bernie does, and he's not afraid to say it." That comment got more than 100 likes. Mm. The next comment was by Maya D. at Northern Arizona University. She was critical of Sanders' stance and wrote, "So the IMF is basically a payday lender that preys on desperate countries? That's how this analysis reads to me." Jim?
Wow, some interesting comments. Thank you so much. G. Abby Lee with us with social media. And you can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. Don't forget to put the E in Abby. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Listening to VOA's International Edition. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi said the pro-Islamic state group Sinai Province and other militant factions pose an existential threat to Egypt and other Arab states as well as the West. That group managed to hit 15 different checkpoints in several attacks on army targets in Sinai Wednesday. VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi spoke with David DeRoche, associate professor at the National Defense University, to learn more. Mohammed, President Sisi came to power with a mandate to finish off terrorism in Egypt. He relied on security measures to counter the Islamist opposition. What do these sophisticated attacks mean?
According to Professor DeRoche, President Sisi contributed to that end by closing off political sphere and excluding Islamists, especially the Muslim Brotherhood, from the political scene.
You could argue that el-Sisi is actually increasing the chances of this, because what he's done is taken, you know, the Ikhwan and the Islamist opposition. He's removed any legitimate means of them to participate in government, to try to get their views heard. And so, you know, your classic insurgency theory would say that, well, if they can't participate in government legitimately, then they're going to do it illegitimately, you know, by fighting. And that's what you're seeing here.
But the Egyptian army is controlling Sinai, and security measures in Cairo is known to be the toughest since the army removal of elected President Mohamed Morsi. So how did Professor DeRoche explain such a setback with two serious attacks in 3 days?
Well, he believes the Egyptian president and his security apparatus are relying heavily on an assumption that the insurgency could be crushed, while heavily handed security practices are alienating more and more Egyptians.
You know, the Egyptian policing model has always been viewed as heavy handed, conducting searches and things like that, and in the process, alienate people who have been neutral in the past who might go over to support the opposition.
Professor DeRoche said that the sophistication of the attacks shows disturbing new capabilities for the Islamist opposition in Egypt, as well as the shortcomings of the Egyptian security apparatus.
The reports of this attack is that it was, you know, rather sophisticated, very well planned, very well carried out. It's the sort of thing that requires a considerable network and a considerable amount of public support. And at the same time, it also shows the immobility, the lack of flexibility, and the real lack of capacity in the Egyptian security forces.
However, Professor Darouche argued that the insurgency in Sinai is not really getting orders from the Islamic State group, but rather using the affiliation with that group as the most frightening group in the world to scare and force local population to side with them against the government. He concluded that the traditional way to end such an insurgency is a compromise to include, in that case, Islamists in the government, a process, he said, never started under el-Sisi.
VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy, he is our senior Middle East correspondent, following all of the action in Egypt. Mohammed, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Here in the United States, as the economy continues to slowly strengthen, we learned that in June, there was a net gain of 223,000 jobs. VOA senior economics correspondent Jim Randall joins us to put this in perspective. Jim?
Well, the unemployment rate dropped to 0.2%, which is beginning to become, that's in the realm of significance. It's not just statistical noise. And it's the lowest it's been since 2008. So that seems, on the face of it, very encouraging. A little discouraging is the fact that the reason for the change is that something like 400,000 people stopped looking for work, and that kind of fusses with the statistics.
So those people who have stopped looking for work are actually still unemployed, but out of the figures statistically.
Yeah, they don't, under our definition of unemployment, if you're not looking, you don't count, which is sensible if you're not looking because you're a college student or you're not looking because you're a stay-at-home parent. But it's a little nuts if you're not looking because you're just discouraged and you don't think there's anything out there for you.
Mm-hmm. You would think that low unemployment would be good for the markets, but sometimes the markets don't necessarily react in a positive manner to
you have to kind of look at the context, because if a really favorable unemployment rate, or if there's a really awful unemployment rate, and that means the Fed is going to delay changing interest rates or something, the market could react to that because they're very much more sensitive to interest rates than they are to the fact that a bunch of people are unemployed.
Mm-hmm. Many people out of work have complained that, well, the jobs that are created are not necessarily the jobs that they are trained for. And I guess we've seen a shift over the last several years of people who have had to retrain themselves to take on some of these new jobs that are now available.
I did a story last week about what's called the skills gap. And there's some research done in Iowa that said, you know, the skills gap would be a lot narrower if employers were willing to offer higher wages. It's clear that the economy has evolved and changed. It used to be if you had a high school diploma and you went to work at a Ford plant or a GM plant or a Whirlpool appliance plant, you could have basically a decent middle class living and work there for most of your life. That's not true anymore, because people in other nations make less money than our workers do, and so they can produce products more cheaply than we can. So that means in order to continue to make high wages, you've got to move up the food chain. You've got to bring something that nobody else can bring to the table.
Jim Randall has one of the most interesting jobs, I think, in the world, covering economics for us at the Voice of America. Jim, thank you for stopping by.
Always fun.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, @PerryCal. or talk to the show anytime, please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked, we love to be seen, and you can reach us anytime.
Black Entertainment Television handed out the BET Awards recently, and the show featured some very special moments. VOA Soul Lounge hostess Shauna Renee stopped by to chat with David Byrd about the show.
This week, Black Entertainment Television honored the best of the best for the past year with the BET Awards at the Microsoft Theater in Los Angeles. Here to talk about who won, who lost, and some of the performances is VOA's Shauna Renee. Shauna, thanks for joining us.
As always, it's a pleasure.
Now, this featured music, television, radio, video, and et cetera, but who were the big stars of the night? Who do you think kind of stole the show?
Well, coming in, we knew that Nicki Minaj, the rapper Nicki Minaj, and Chris Brown were probably going to show up more than anyone else. They had the most nominations of anyone else, and they both ended up going home with awards. But I think for me, there were two performances that really stood out. If you were around and in the clubs and having a good time, let's say the mid-90s, then you definitely know Bad Boy Records. They were running things at that time, and they just celebrated their 25th anniversary, and Puffy brought back almost everyone for a massive performance that included Mace, who we hadn't seen for a while, Faith Evans, who we haven't seen for a while, 112, and everyone got uber excited about Lil' Kim. We hadn't seen or heard from Lil' Kim for some time. So,
yeah, I haven't heard her name in any kind of music publication for a long time.
Well, she's been involved in a few internet beefs, as it were, with some younger and upcoming female hip-hop artists, but she recently had a baby. So she's been at home doing the mom thing, but she looked fabulous and she sounded great. And as is always expected with Bad Boy, it was just one of the most energetic performances. I was standing on the couch, dancing along, having a great time. So that definitely stood out for me. And the other piece was the Janet Jackson tribute. She took home the first Icon Award, and her tribute featured the dance piece of Janet. We know Janet is a phenomenal entertainer and performer.
Right.
And a lot of that comes with the incredible choreography and dancing. And Ciara, as well as Jason Derulo, actually did some really interesting stuff with them. Ciara, flawless choreography. She got the look down. Janet showed up. She was there. She accepted the award. She looked absolutely beautiful, and she gave a heartfelt speech, and she expressed how excited she is about coming back and performing and reconnecting with the audience, and it sent chills down my spine. I'm so happy she's coming back.
Well, speaking of people who've made a career in this industry, Smokey Robinson was also honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award.
Yes, he was.
And had something to say to the young people about, you know, be thankful for the fact that you, I think he called show business a bittersweet wine.
He was very humbled, obviously, by the award, but I appreciated the fact that a man who has had such a phenomenal career could stand on stage and speak very frankly and honestly about where younger people need to be in terms of their mind, their talent, and their actions if this business is going to continue and black culture in general is going to continue to grow.
All right, thanks a lot, Shauna. That's Shauna Renee. You can hit her up on Twitter at VOA Lady DJ or at VOA underscore music. You can also hear her host the Soul Lounge. Find that by logging on to our website, www.voanews.com.
And our thanks to David Byrd and Shauna Renee. As he mentioned, you can find out more about this at our website. It's voanews.com. We're also on mobile. If you happen to have a smartphone, just download the app for Voice of America, and you can get all of the latest news and updates, and we'll even send you alerts when breaking news is happening. Stop by our Facebook page, VOA Asia, where we post most of our stories that we produce, plus some special things you're just not going to find anywhere else. Facebook, it's VOA Asia. We're also prominently on Twitter, where you can always follow us there, VOA underscore IE. That's our account for International Edition. We hope you stop by and join us for Twitter. Follow us there. I'm at VOA Stevenson, and some of our social media gurus, of course, you're familiar with, at Michael_Lippin. And G. Abby Lee has joined our team. You heard her earlier in the program, at G. Abby Lee with an E in Abby. So we hope you follow all of those kind folks. As you may know, we're coming up on the July 4th holiday here in the United States. That's our Independence Day. In Connecticut, the town of Willimantic has an annual Independence Day parade. It once again will be including the traditional Little League teams, floats sponsored by local businesses, fire trucks, and politicians. But for the 30th consecutive year, there will be no marching bands. In what has become a rather offbeat tradition, the participants and the spectators will instead be carrying radios, all tuned to the same local station that will provide the traditional marching band music. More than 5,000 people expected to attend the town's annual Boombox Parade, which kicks off early on Saturday. It dates back to 1986, when the town couldn't find a marching band. In an ironic twist, the marching band that was supposed to appear that year has the recorded music for this year's Boombox Parade. Should be a lot of fun out there on the streets. We hope you enjoy the holiday, or however you celebrate the July 4th Independence Weekend. I know it's not Independence Day around the world, but celebrate with us. And we're glad that you joined us today for VOA's International Edition. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Zena Bobdell-Rockman. I'm Jim Stevenson. We hope you have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
While there's been much encouraging news about the Ebola epidemic in West Africa in recent months, new infections of the virus continue, and the United States remains committed to doing what it takes to stop them. U.S. Ebola treatment units and basic response infrastructure are in place, and thousands of U.S.-supported civilian responders are at work to fight the disease. It's killed more than 11,000 people in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, and a handful of other countries, including our own. Liberia has been declared Ebola-free, but is still within a 90-day period on heightened security for recurrence of the disease. New cases continue to emerge elsewhere, with 8 recently identified in Sierra Leone and 12 in Guinea. Cases continue in areas bordering Guinea-Bissau, and efforts to ensure that country is better prepared for Ebola cases are underway. The U.S. National Institutes of Health is conducting trials on various candidate Ebola vaccines, including a controlled trial on the effectiveness of one vaccine in particular. NIH is also testing therapeutic drug candidates to treat those who have been infected, working to improve diagnosis of the disease, which has so far required sophisticated, labor-intensive DNA analysis, and trying to better understand how it causes the disease. In other words, the United States is supporting a wide range of research on prevention and treatment of Ebola. Meanwhile, a partnership between U.S. and Liberian researchers is studying approximately 7,500 people in that country, including 1,500 who survived Ebola within the last 2 years. Health investigators want to better understand Ebola's long-term health consequences and determine if survivors develop long-term immunity that will protect them from future infection. They also would like to better understand how the Ebola virus can persist in some organs of survivors long after they appear to have recovered, and the degree of risk that they can transmit the virus to others. While we have succeeded in controlling the exponential growth of the disease, getting to zero cases will require a sustained international response. The fight is far from over, and we remain committed to achieving an Ebola-free West Africa. The research U.S. and other scientists are carrying out now will improve the odds of preventing any future outbreak of Ebola from spreading, as the 2014 epidemic did.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.